an ingenious contraption at the heart of a captivating novel about colonialism, ambition, and self-determination.
Tipu's Tiger is this really spectacular 18th century automaton, and it's composed of this 6-foot-long wooden tiger that is mauling the throat of an English soldier. And back in the day when it worked, you could turn this hand crank and the tiger would grunt and the soldier would groan and there was organ music. So it was really kind of grotesque and irreverent and sinister and captivating. And I was just really interested in the people who made it, the ruler who commissioned it, and how it traveled actually from India to England.
That's Tanya James. We talk with her about her acclaimed new novel, Loot. Then Wahini Vara tells us about her new collection of stories, This Is Salvaged. And we do a mini review of a stunning new book for gardeners. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Tanya James's new novel, Loot, is a page-turner about a boy on a quest, a girl determined to make her way in a man's world, and a mechanical construction, an automaton, that exemplifies the Indian resistance to British colonialism. Set in the waning years of the 18th century, Loot is a hero's journey, a love story, a coming-of-age story, and a heist novel that traces the bloody legacy of colonialism across two continents. It made me want to read Tanya James's other three novels. I spoke with James in August. Here's our conversation. Well, Tanya James, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
Your wonderful novel, Loot, is set in the old Indian state of Mysore, which is now called Karnataka, if I hope I pronounced that correctly, and it's set at the turn of the 18th century. At its center is the creation of an automaton, a tiger, for Tipu Sultan, who I believe was called the Tiger of Mysore. Situate us in the time and place, and then tell us about the real automaton and why it was created.
So Loot takes place at the turn of the 18th century in South India and the South Indian Kingdom of Mysore, as you mentioned. And it's really an interesting moment in history because it's sort of a turning point where the British East India Company is becoming more aggressive in their tactics. They'd always been a trading company, but now they were really interested at this point, very interested in the Southern Peninsula, which is where Mysore is. And Mysore was one of the kingdoms that was standing in their way of taking control of the peninsula. And so this was a really interesting period to me. And I actually didn't know anything about the historical context when I first came across Tipu's Tiger, which is the automaton at the center of this book. Tipu's Tiger is this really spectacular 18th century automaton, and it's composed of this 6-foot-long wooden tiger that is mauling the throat of an English soldier. And back in the day when it worked, you could turn this hand crank and the tiger would grunt and the soldier would groan and there was organ music. So it was really kind of grotesque and irreverent and sinister and captivating. And I was just really interested in who made it, the people who made it, the ruler who commissioned it, and how it traveled actually from India to England. It now resides in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London.
And hence at least one of the meanings of loot.
Yes, loot comes from the Sanskrit, has Sanskrit roots from the word lutna, which means to plunder.
Oh, I did not know that. So now the story is that the part of this that's fiction is that you have the tiger created by 17-year-old Abbas, a woodworker, and also by a Frenchman, Lucien Deleuze. Tell us about these two characters and the dynamics between them.
Yeah, so I initially thought I will find out everything there is to find out about the people who made this automaton. And then I quickly was confronted by the fact that There is no written record about who these people were. All I could tell was that the exterior was probably created by a local artisan or artisans because it had that, it was like had a carving style that was common to the area. And then the interior was probably French in making. And so the confluence of two different kind of perspectives immediately had me thinking about, well, what wouldn't it be interesting to look at a Mysorean woodcarver and a French clockmaker? And I knew that the ruler at that time, Tipu Sultan, he really was interested in European technology, and he was always bringing in, you know, French artisans and engineers into his court. And he had one French clockmaker at his court whose name I could find. And that name was Lez, L-E-Z-E. I couldn't find anything else about him. But I just took that one little detail and sort of built this character out of that name, a character who is basically like a mentor to Abbas, who is the woodcarver. He sort of sees something, some talent, something in Abbas worth nurturing. And it's because of Dulez that Abbas has this idea that one day he might be able to become more than he ever thought possible. One day he might also become a person who can make automatons and be a great artist of some kind.
And, you know, the fact that you could not find the actual creators of this, I think is very telling, because what you have in the book is that both their names are inscribed within the mechanism of, in fact, Lucien Dulez inscribes both their names within that mechanism. And so that talks very much to a theme of this book of how people step out of their assigned roles within the hierarchies of colonialism to fight to be treated as dignified, fully self-determinate human beings. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something about the fact that I couldn't find their names on this object. When I went to the V&A Museum and I saw Tipu's tiger, the way it's displayed is sort of like it's displayed among other artifacts that were taken from the siege or the wars. And like, so there was some Tipu Sultan's robe and Tipu Sultan's gun, and then there's this Tipu's tiger. And seeing all of these things together really has us looking at these objects through an ethnographic lens and as like objects of a subjugated people. But I think about how once you put a name to a work of art, it changes. Our relationship to it changes. It is somehow we're looking at it differently and perhaps seeing the artist in the work itself. And so that moment when Abbas sees his name on the automaton or realizes that his name is on it somewhere, it is, I think that's one of the things that makes him interested in becoming an artist and being and sort of, you know, separating his vision out from that of his mentor and everybody else around him who's telling him he should kind of stick to the straight and narrow and do what he's expected to do. I feel a kind of, I'm also just thinking just now as we were talking about this about my grandmother who started painting when she was in her 80s. And one day I was like, why don't you write your name? You need to sign your name. And I just remember her hesitation at that, you know, that there's something you're claiming, that you're claiming your own vision and your own authority when you put your name to a piece of work. And there's something very human about that and universal about that, that desire to kind of express yourself as individual. So I think that is one of the things that the book is exploring.
And also, you know, in a way, I mean, the title Loot applies most obviously to the tiger, but could not it also apply to the subjugated peoples of India and Abbas being one of them, and that this is a way that he determines he's not going to be loot?
That's a great point. Yeah, I do think there's something about the word loot too that was interesting to me, in that people can be, I guess, plundered of their dreams or of their agency. I do think also language can also be looted. Like language is moving around, like English is born of so many different languages. And I just love the idea that that words migrate, people migrate, and loot as a word is a sort of an encapsulation of that too.
Yes, and of course, he migrates as well. But before we get to that part of the story, there's a love story that also develops in this book, a really charming one, between Abbas and the daughter of a French expatriate, Jehan. So tell us about her.
Yes, like as you mentioned, Jehan is, in the first part of the book, we're introduced to her as Jehan. She's raised by Mysorean women. Her mother's a Mysorean woman who was married to a French expat. So she is in many ways not isolated, but just there's some distance between her and everyone she knows and loves because she is, you know, she is of two ethnicities. She is markedly different, visibly different. She's, you know, fair where everyone else is darker skinned, and she has a handle on French. And so this kind of gives her this way of moving through different worlds that serves her well when we meet her again in France. We meet her first in Mysore, and she meets Abbas as a young child, and she's immediately taken with him and sort of captivated by this toy he makes, which just makes her a simple top. But that wonder, that kind of thrill sort of stays with her even after she grows older into a young woman and moves to France. And then she meets him again as a young woman she's in her early 20s by that point. But I think something about that, the wonder of that first meeting stayed with her. And I think also she sees something of he is sort of a similar ilk in that he is also somewhat different from everybody around him, and that he's an artist and nobody quite understands him. So in some ways they're cut from a similar cloth, I think.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with novelist Tanya James about her acclaimed new novel, Loot. And they're both really seeking to define themselves in their own very real way to the world. And, you know, Jehan is a young woman at a time when young women, especially young women who really didn't have very good means, you know, were at the mercy of a profoundly discriminatory society. And yet she just boldly sallies forth with a complete sense of her own worth.
Yeah, this was sort of a challenge for me because I wanted the character to be of her time. But it occurred to me that it's actually hard to write a female character from this time who can make the sort of bold moves that we expect of characters in fiction, particularly characters who are following. You know, how do we get them out the door when they don't necessarily have the means and maybe in a precarious sort of social situation? And so I was aware that this is kind of pushing on the limits of what people might have been actually capable of the time. And I thought, well, so long as I can kind of make it believable within the world of the story that this is the sort of person who has no family left, virtually no family left, and has decided she has to take a huge risk and make some bold moves. But that was sort of a challenge for me in thinking about how to get her to get out the door and have us believe what she's willing to do and what risks she's willing to take.
Well, I think you succeed admirably because it was a question to me. But then I also thought, well, she's living in a revolutionary time. I mean, she's living, you know, the French Revolution has happened. Women were certainly part of that, as a matter of fact. So you can't even really treat a society as one in which there are no people who transgress the rules, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. So the instability of the time does contribute to what people are pushed to take on and have to take on.
Now, back to some of the history, I'd like to ask you, first of all, about the woodworking, because it's quite detailed. And I wonder if you could share some of your process on how you delved into the intricacies of 18th century automatons.
That was a challenge for me. So woodworking, it was during the pandemic that I was writing this book, and I wasn't sure how I was going to go about. I thought, you know, how am I going to like actually get in there? And how am I going to write about this stuff if I've never physically done it? And so I signed up for classes online, like, well, maybe it was one class, but it was with a woodworker who was talking about his process. And then I read memoirs of woodworkers or how-to books. And I think that what I realized is that no matter what field of expertise I was writing about, whatever, you know, if it's woodworking or if it's making automatons or whatever it is, that it's not really about convincing the reader that I know how to make anything out of wood. What the reader really wants is the character's emotional connection to their craft. And what's also interesting is the way characters think about their craft. And you're a writer and I'm a writer, but if someone were to ask both of us, what do you hate about writing? What do you love about writing? We would have very different answers, perhaps. And so it's sort of that thinking about the way characters talk to each other about their craft and the way they think about themselves in relationship to the craft that makes that relationship to art come alive, I think. But I did do a lot of research, and then I sort of tried to transplant myself as a writer. What do I find difficult about writing? One of the things I find difficult is about relinquishing my control. And so that was something I explored as this character explores as a woodworker, you know, that you can't have total control over what you're doing. And you sometimes have to go with the flaws and let them lead you in some way. So I was just always trying to find my own personal relationship to my work in the writing about woodworking, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. I mean, for one thing, my father was a master carpenter, and I've done a lot of woodworking myself. So I completely related to your descriptions of how he felt about wood. But also, as a writer, I wonder if you could say more about the limitations. I've done other crafts as well, and I've always, what I enjoy about wood or other crafts, I've done a lot of fabric collage and work with tapestries. And what I love is the very limitations of the medium that demand for you to work within those limitations and then create something that transcends them. So I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about your process as a writer.
That's so interesting about the, you know, the limitations. I'm thinking of maybe, is that maybe analogous to the limitations of form or the limitations of whatever form I'm imposing on the story. That is a kind of limitation, but that limitation actually becomes a kind of freedom. It allows you to do things you didn't necessarily know you could do at the outset. I do think that process of discovery, and I'm wondering, maybe you can tell me, Francesca, but I'm wondering if the process of discovering what you can do with this particular medium is also part of what makes the work delightful. That from the outset, if you know exactly what you're going to do and you know what you're going to execute, there's something kind of, perhaps for me in writing, something sort of flat about that. But it's in sort of discovering the sort of twists and turns that the work takes that's where the wonder comes, like the mystery of what you actually are going to end up making. Is that some?
Yes. I mean, that's why the limitations are part of the draw of the craft. That's exactly it. Yeah, and I think you said that beautifully. Now back to the story. So Abbas and Jean actually go to England to try to get the tiger back. And this is something that really is being pushed by Abbas, you know, although Jean has a certain interest, but he has a deeper interest. Why does he want to get the tiger back?
Well, in a practical sense, he thinks he needs the tiger in order to prove to a clockmaker in Rouen, in France, that this is what I did. And therefore, since I was able to do this, would you please apprentice me? So he's kind of struck this informal agreement with this clockmaker in France, who is not Dulez, because Dulez at this point has died. But he tries to convince this clockmaker, I made this automaton. I have a picture of it. Can you take me on? And this other clockmaker says, I'll take you on if you can prove to me, bring this thing here. And it just seems like such a wild and improbable task to take on. But he really feels at this point, he's come a long way. It's been many years. He's had a lot of ups and downs, more downs than ups in his life. And he feels like this is the only way I'm going to be able to realize my dream of becoming a maker of automatons. And so that's why he goes to England with Jeanne. They come up with this whole idea to sort of swindle the person who currently owns the Tipu's tiger to kind of swindle her out of it. And so there's this practical reason this he sees this as his only doorway to the future. And I think there's also this sense that he feels this is the only thing he has done with his life. He has left behind his family. He has lost everything else. And this is all he has left of himself. This is all he has left to show of himself. And the idea of letting it go and letting go of is akin to sort of letting go of this lifelong dream he's had. So it's sort of a very high stakes thing for him that there's an urgency to his desire to get it back.
Yeah, it's more than just a practical thing. It's really about who he is. And so it made me start thinking a lot about the role of objects as symbols. I mean, actually, the whole book, The Tipu Tiger in itself, you know, the significance of objects in telling history, historical narratives, in telling personal stories. I wonder if you had some thoughts on that.
That's a great point. Like, I do think that most of the interesting discoveries I made, or the things that felt most immediate to me, were when I encountered objects, particularly when historical accounts have been lost to history or erased. You know, I remember one thing I did was I went to a country house in England called Strawberry Hill House. And it's full of it was built and owned by a guy named Horace Walpole, who just had a huge collection of Orientalist things. And it was in going through that house and kind of examining all of these objects that this character, I sort of fictionalized this woman who would own such a house and own Tipu's tiger. It was through kind of examining these objects that she sort of came to life, because those objects were a sort of portrait of her obsessions. And even Tipu's tiger itself, I didn't really have much by way of accounts about who Tipu Sultan was. I knew, you know, just by looking at it, you can tell that he hated the British. He hated the British East India Company. They were his biggest, greatest rival. But I felt like there was something about it that was also funny that also made me think this, perhaps my fictionalized version of this person would have a sense of humor. But there's almost, you know, historical texts can sometimes, to me, like I felt they could be sort of dry and dense and distant, whereas an object that somebody owned could be so personal and yet mysterious. So sometimes objects I find are more inviting even than texts that contain so much more information.
Right. I was reading something, I think today, about, you know, there's two kinds of people. There are the people who are minimalists. They like to have nothing in their house or in their rooms. And there are people who invest their rooms with all these meaningful symbols. I am of the latter, I have to say.
I am too, though I don't know if they have meaning. This clutter plus I think some objects with meaning, but I agree. I like the aesthetic of minimalists, but I just feel like it's in my DNA that I will never be that.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with novelist Tanya James about her acclaimed new novel, Loot. Now, you did mention this new character. You know, I found there were two new characters, this lady and her butler. And her butler is also from the same region of India, from Mysore. And without giving too much away, I wonder if you could talk about the dynamics between the two parties, between Abbas and Jeanne on the one hand, and Lady Selwyn and her butler, Rum, the dynamics between them, because what I found is it would be so easy to caricature them, but they're not caricatured at all. These were relationships that may have started out within the confines of how people would judge each other according to their station in life, but ended up being something quite different.
Yeah, I so Lady Selwyn is the woman who owns this country house. She's very wealthy, And Rum is her sort of right-hand man in all, you know, business affairs. And initially, they both did feel like caricatures to me. When I would write them in the early drafts, when I look back, they do feel quite sort of like outlines of people. And, you know, initially I thought that can be fine, especially for comic effect. It can be very useful to have characters who are kind of do have sort of expected personality traits. And so, but then I felt that if I'm going to spend time with these characters, I need more than comic relief from them. I need to know more. And I do feel like points of vulnerability are really important to me in terms of engaging myself and getting interested in characters. Not that they have to be likable, not that they have to do things that I approve of, but just recognizing their points of vulnerability. And I think for Lady Selwyn, you know, she is, you know, a creature of her times. She loves Orientalist art and thinks herself to be have a advanced sort of worldview, but, you know, she's also sort of limited in her way of thinking about Rum, and they have actually a romantic relationship, but it is somewhat toxic as well because she is his employer and she has power over him. At the same time, I found her to be, I came to really feel for her because she also is, you know, new money. She's not respected and not seen as sophisticated by, you know, other people of the aristocratic class. So she's sort of in a lonely position, and Rum is kind of her only friend. And he too is sort of in a lonely position because he is the only Indian person on her staff. He sort of occupies this middle position. He's not quite downstairs. He's not quite upstairs. He's sort of in the middle, which nobody likes. Nobody feels comfortable with that. And he's pretty isolated. It's a small country town and village, and there are no other Indian people until Abbas and Jean come along. So they, in some ways, they kind of suit each other, even as there is a kind of discomfort too about their power structure.
Finally, this book explores, obviously, the impact of colonialism and the struggles of individuals to maintain their dignity and their self-determination in spite of it. You wrote a previous novel, The Tusk That Did the Damage, I believe it's called.
Yes.
And it's about the exploitation of nature, and it features an elephant who fights back against the exploitation. So is there a connection between these themes of colonialism and the exploitation of nature for you?
You know, I never actually thought about that. I do see a kind of common thread across a lot of my work, and perhaps across these two books, in that there's oftentimes someone who is misunderstood by everyone around them, or who feels misunderstood. And oftentimes they are looking for connection in some ways, but also afraid to risk connection. And feel some sense of dislocation and some sense of they belong somewhere else. And I don't know these things when I'm sitting out to write about them. I oftentimes am just attracted to something, some character, whether it's an elephant or a wood carver from the 18th century, that people who are creatures or perspectives that seem so far outside of my own. But these sort of themes do keep kind of circling back. But it's interesting, but that what you're bringing up is that both characters are suffering from or are part of systems of oppression that are much larger than they are, whether it's colonialism or human encroachment.
So I think we have a little bit of time left. So do you have something that you would like to read to us?
Sure. Okay. Abbas returns his attention to the block of wood. It's still something of a stranger to him, this piece of tree, something he is coming to know through continued conversation. And as with any conversation between strangers, their talk begins tentatively, tap of mallet against wood, loosening forefinger and thumb, gaining speed as he goes, wood chips shooting this way and that as he dissolves into the work until he is no longer a toy maker serving Tipu Sultan. He is wood and mallet and chisel. A nutty aroma rises from the flesh of the wood, its surface as dappled as wind-blown water.
That's absolutely wonderful. And as is your wonderful novel, Lute, Tanya James, it's been a delight to talk with you about it.
Thank you, Francesca. This was actually a really, really fun conversation and questions I haven't had before, so it was great.
In addition to Lute, Tanya James is the author of three other novels. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an excerpt from Lute. Next up, a collection of short stories from the multi-genre writer Wahine Vara. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Wahine Vara is a journalist, editor, novelist, short story writer, essayist, and playwright. You might know her from her debut novel, The Immortal King Rao, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Now, Vara has come out with a wonderful collection of her short stories, some of which took many years to write. They feature, for example, an experimental artist who builds an ark based on the biblical story of Noah, a pair of teenagers who seek to grapple with their grief and seek intimacy as phone sex operators, a woman who tries to rise above the drunken mess of her own life to become a loving aunt. These are flawed characters that nonetheless remind us of the love and care we all seek to give and receive, and the meaning that we find in our relationships with others. Wahine Vara, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me, Francesca.
So this story collection, This Is Salvaged, I want to just start out with the title story. It concerns an artist who does installations. He's commissioned to create an ark using homeless people as laborers. It's a very complicated kind of a project. And I just wondered where you got the idea of this. Tell us about the story.
So this artist is sort of in middle age, as I am, and I am also an artist. And he, I think he's facing a kind of crisis of confidence. He wants to make art that's meaningful in the world. And yet, given all the big problems that exist in the world, he's not sure what kind of art corresponds properly to the world we actually live in. This is all kind of in the subtext. I don't know if it's said explicitly on the page, but that's sort of how I think of this character. And so he decides he wants to do something big. And he has this idea to build an ark. I don't remember where the idea came from, for me, to be honest. I do remember that an early version of the story involved this ark. Something, without giving away any spoilers, you know, something bad happens with the ark. And I remember I workshopped an early version of the story in a class with the writer Alan Gerganis. And he said to me, you're going to have something bad happen to the arc. You need to really spend more time building the arc on the page in the first place. And so an early version of the story sort of focuses more on what eventually happens with the arc, which is not good. But the story that exists now is much more about this big effort to build the arc in the first place. I think that was really resonant, useful advice that I pass on to students all the time. Like if you're going to break something down, you need to build it up in the first place, whether it's something physical, a physical object or a relationship or whatever. And so that's how the story evolved.
It's really not so much about the arc itself, but the relationships around it. He is an installation artist. He's been commissioned to do this by a Christian evangelical group that pairs itself with a homeless shelter. There's a character of a young woman who is the director of the homeless shelter and various complicated relationships with some of the homeless men.
Yes.
So it's really about the people. And the thing that I actually found interesting is this character, the main character, Marlon, he's not, you know, he's kind of a dick, I have to say.
Yes, I would agree.
So why did you pick this as the title story of your collection?
Mm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, kind of a dick. I think we all are kind of a dick internally, right? There's some aspect of all of us that is reflected in Marlon, I think. I think there's a particularly male, probably, character to his dickishness in the case of this character. I chose this as the title story, and I chose this title for the collection, This Is Salvaged, because this story, I think, shares something in common with all the stories, and the title of this story sort of reflects most clearly that element of all the stories, which is this idea that in loss, in grief, in disconnectedness from the world and from one another, we have a tendency to hold on to something, to kind of grasp for whatever still remains. And there's something upsetting in that fact, and there's something kind of beautiful in it as well. And I wanted the collection to sort of be imbued with that idea.
I'm interested to hear that is a common theme, because for one thing, the language that you use in your stories is very, you know, the sentences are short. It doesn't go for kind of lyricism, but there is a real attention both to the ugliness and the beauty of life, it seems to me.
I think so. There was this interesting review that came out recently that was sort of the first full-length review of the collection in High Country News, written by Hannah Rivers, that I found really interesting, because the focus of the review is on the kind of the grotesque elements of the collection and the way in which grotesque aspects of the way in which our bodies work is present in the collection. And it's interesting, like, that's certainly one aspect of the collection. And then at the same time, I think, you know, I'm interested in the beauty in the world as well, alongside the ugliness. I love that review. I love the way in which, like, it sort of zeroed in on that aspect of it. I think both interest me because I like dichotomies. I like complex, putting on the page the things that are complex about the world. And also because, like, that's just how the world is, and I want to reflect it in its reality.
I thought the story I, Buffalo, is really emblematic of that approach. It's the story of a woman, a young woman, I mean, she's in her 30s. She has fallen spectacularly from grace. She, you know, committed a no-no in her job and lost her job. And she really struggles with alcoholism. A lot of the story revolves around the smell of her vomit. But it's also a story about love. She's a very loving, loving aunt to a four-year-old. So tell us about this story.
Yeah, so this is a story, this woman who commits a no-no at work. She's a lawyer, a kind of corporate lawyer in San Francisco, you know, like, working somewhat more on the side of evil than on the side of good, I would say. And I think I wanted this crisis she's experiencing to sort of echo the crisis of San Francisco, where I lived for a long time, over the kind of last years of the 90s and the first years of the 2000s, up until now, in which there was sort of, like, I think that city faced and is facing a kind of moral crisis. So she, you know, she wants to be connected with people. She was once very close with her sister, and then over the course of the story, she has vomited somewhere in her house because she was drunk, and she doesn't know where it is. And her sister's coming to visit, along with her beloved, with her husband and her daughter, who is the beloved niece of the narrator, the protagonist of the story. And so the reason the story revolves around the smell of her vomit, as you say, is that somebody smells it over the course of their time together during this visit. And they decide that they should figure out where in the house this vomit is. And so the story revolves around this mystery and this effort to figure out where the vomit is in the home of the protagonist, which of course, you know, can be read as a metaphor for this narrator's personal crisis and maybe the city's broader crisis and our sort of social crisis in general during these past 25 years of our history.
And the connection to the buffalo?
Yes. So this narrator early in the book, she goes to, for any listeners who are familiar with San Francisco, you may be familiar with this bison paddock in Golden Gate Park, where, you know, you can be taking a walk in Golden Gate Park and all of a sudden you see these bison hanging out, which was part of a conservation effort many years ago. So the narrator sees these bison and suddenly feels a connection to one bison in particular, and like feels a kind of bison-y energy transferred to her. And that energy, you know, which is meant to be a kind of wild, natural energy in contrast with the energy of increasingly corporate San Francisco. She feels imbued with that energy, and that energy sort of gets carried with her later on as her sister visits and the story progresses.
I mean, I thought of it as it's a story of redemption of the buffalo, right? And in some way, this character, you know, we hope for her redemption as well, which does in a way come, I think, in the, you know, the last paragraphs of the story. I mean, just the care and the love that she feels for her niece.
But yeah, I mean, I'm glad that came through, because certainly that was something I was thinking about.
And then the first story, I think, was so interesting, The Irates. It actually seems to contain two stories. The first is about a brother who dies young of cancer, kind of an ideal. One gets the sense that he is the favored sibling of the family. He's very accomplished. He's very involved with, you know, caring about justice in the world. And yet he dies. And the second story is about his teenage sisters who, after his death, start working as phone sex workers. What is the connection between the two threads of the story?
So I think I can admit to you that in 2001, the year that the Twin Towers fell, my older sister also died. She died of cancer, like the character's brother in this story. And that summer, my best friend and I had telemarketing jobs. We weren't working anywhere near a phone sex operation, but we did have telemarketing jobs. And we had those telemarketing jobs when the Twin Towers fell. And I think the kind of emotional germ that stuck with me and sort of became the foundation for this story is that in my own grief over my sister's death, our country's kind of collective grief over 9/11 somehow felt small. It wasn't in any objective sense small, obviously, but in my kind of, you know, the self-absorption that sort of happens as part of grief, I couldn't feel that. So that is where that story started. I started writing that story in 2008. So 7 years after the Twin Towers fell, 7 years after the death of my sister. And I kept working on it. I just finished working on it probably, you know, when I put the finishing touches on this manuscript in, let's see, I guess early this year. And so it's something that I've revisited over and over and over. I think at the time that I started the book, that feeling was still so visceral that I, you know, I almost was still in that feeling. And now I have some critical distance, and I think was able to sort of revise the story in such a way that, like, you had a sense of, I hope, a kind of authorial understanding of the bigger picture in which this narrator, whose brother has died and who's working as a telemarketer when the Twin Towers fall, you kind of have an understanding of the kind of social and economic and political context in which she exists.
Yes. And why do you call it The Irates?
It's called The Irates because, well, the kind of superficial reason it's called The Irates is that in this job, as in the telemarketing job that I had, there would be these people who you would label. So when I worked as a telemarketer, there would be these people that you would label as irates because you called them and they shouted at you and or swore at you or whatever. And like, that was the only situation where it was okay to just hang up on them. And then you wrote in capital letters on your computer terminal, "Irate." And so we called these people the irates. You know, "I got an irate" is something that we would say, as the characters in the story do. So the story is called the irates because of that on a superficial level. But also there's a lot of anger in the story. I think there's a lot of anger in the story on the part of a lot of people involved, not only this narrator and her best friend who've lost somebody very important to them, but, you know, one could read it also as applying to the people who flew that plane through the Twin Towers. You could see it as applying to sort of grieving Americans responding to that terrorist action, right? And so it's in some ways like a story about the relationship between grief and anger, I think.
Waheen Uvara, I want to talk about one more story before I want to ask you some more general questions about writing. And I found this also very affecting. You Are Not Alone. It's a story about an 8-year-old who is really navigating, it seems, the lives of the adults around her, trying to figure out a way to make sure that she stays safe while, you know, being around adults who are, you know, in some way not safe, incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. You can say more about the story if you'd like to. And the thing that struck me was point of view in the story, how most of the story was very much in the point of view of this 8-year-old and felt very real to me. And then at the very end, it switches to her new stepmother, who is named The Stranger.
So this also is a story that I worked on for many, many years that I started, I think, in 2008 or 2009 and finished just recently. And for a long time, this story was very grounded in the perspective of the kind of the protagonist, the main character, this young girl who's going to visit her father and his new wife in Florida. She's sort of bewildered and has a kind of existential sense of dread or fear over the whole thing. You know, her mom has had a kind of mental breakdown and is not available to her. Her dad has been kind of somewhat in and out of her life. There's this character, the stranger, who's the new wife, and she doesn't know what to make of this person. And so this young child is feeling fairly estranged from the world around her, I would say, and isolated. And I think that sort of the character of the stranger sort of personifies that sense of estrangement, I think, in the main character, which for most of this story's life, I was really interested in. I was focused on the estrangement felt by this character. And then relatively recently, I can't remember when, but in the last sort of year or two of this story's life, after it had already been published in a literary journal, it occurred to me that it would potentially be a more interesting story or a truer story if it accounted for the kind of inner lives of the characters around this protagonist, including her father, and then most notably the stranger herself, because those people, of course, also have inner lives and conflicts and traumas that we, you know, when we're going through our lives as individuals, like, it's hard for us to perceive the kind of full humanity of other people, especially when we're sort of deeply involved with our own problems. And so at one point, there's sort of a kind of culminating point toward the end of the story where the story opens up and we kind of get a deeper sense of the kind of consciousness of the stranger in particular. And I think, you know, what that's meant to do is show the way in which each of us, if I can generalize, sort of each of us in our moments of deep isolation are always surrounded by other people who may be feeling something similar, right? Maybe feeling a similar sense of isolation, a desire to connect, bumping up against the feeling of isolation. But we don't know about it because we're going through this privately in our own thoughts. And so that was the idea that I was trying to convey with that story, especially the ending of it.
And it's interesting to me that you work on stories for years. Talk a little bit about your process, because you do a lot of different kinds of writing. You've been a reporter. In fact, you were a tech reporter.
That's right.
And you wrote a novel that was a finalist for the Pulitzer, The Immortal King Rao. So tell us about your approach to short story writing.
So I graduated from college in 2004, and I started working as a tech reporter sort of right away at the Wall Street Journal. And then a few years after that, in 2008, I took a leave of absence and I went to graduate school for creative writing at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And while I was there, that was a really kind of fertile period in my life for my creative writing. It was the first time since I finished college, I guess, or maybe the first time ever that I'd really been in a place where I could focus entirely on writing. And that's where I started a number, about half of the stories in the story collection. It's where I started my novel. And then what happened was I left grad school after 2 years and went back to work at the Wall Street Journal. And sort of ever since then have been pretty much working full time as a reporter, first at the Wall Street Journal, then at the New Yorker, and then as a freelancer, and fitting in my creative work sort of when I could. And so I think, you know, I love working on things for a long time, as you can see from both the novel and the story collection, which I worked on for, you know, in the case of both of those, for 12 or 13 years or more. But I think it's also a function of the fact that I just, you know, I've had a lot of other things going on in my life. And so it took me a long time to get through both of those projects. There has been a really interesting silver lining to that, though, which is that, and I think you can sort of hear it when I talk about those two stories, The Irates, as well as You Are Not Alone, which is that when you spend 15 years working on a given story, 10 to 15 years working on a given story, you change as a person as well. And I hope you gain perspective as a writer and as a person. And so I have been able to look at these drafts that represented a version of myself 10 years ago and sort of see a bigger picture in a way that I wasn't able to at the time that I first drafted these stories, right? And so the stories sort of become fundamentally different in the process of revision because the person who's revising them is a different person from the person who wrote them in the first place, and therefore can sort of bring a kind of broader perspective to the page than that version of that person from 10 years ago wouldn't have been able to.
Oh, that's so interesting. And, you know, short stories often, they need to strike a balance between brevity and depth. How do you work to bring out the complexity of your stories within the constraints of the shorter narrative?
It's hard. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I have to say in response to that question that there's a kind of magic in it. I don't know how it happens. Usually I don't come to the page saying, here are the things that I want to convey. Now let me go ahead and try to convey them in a short amount of space. Usually these things are percolating in my mind, but I don't have words for them. I wouldn't be able to articulate them out loud. And so it's through the process of writing that that gets articulated. And honestly, like I just try over and over and over. And in the case of many of these stories over the course of a decade, and eventually something clicks.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about some of the other work you do, or maybe not work, but your volunteerism, maybe. You give back as a writer. Tell us about Periolis. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. This is a collective that mentors writers of color. Tell us more about it.
Yes, I will. So I hope some of your listeners belong to this demographic and we'll find it useful to know about. It's called Para Plus, and it's a mentorship collective serving writers of color. And so what we are is a group of writers. We started out as about 50 kind of established writers who, you know, had been publishing, had been kind of active in the literary world, interested in mentoring emerging writers of color. This will be our fourth year, I think. So we started out, our first year was 2021. With a group of 50 emerging writers that we mentored. But what has happened since then has been really interesting in that our mentees themselves, who we call Para Plus Fellows, have kind of taken up the mantle of Para Plus. We're a collective. We're not a nonprofit or an organization. We don't, you know, there's no money that ever changes hands. Everything's free. Everything's donated, including our time. And so the fellows themselves have sort of taken this collective spirit upon themselves and have made Para Plus something broader than what we anticipated. And so what it is now is, it's still a mentorship collective. There are still every year about 50 of us who are more established, who mentor, who each year select 50 people, 50 emerging writers to mentor. But then those mentees become part of the kind of broader Paraplus collective and enter in community, not only with their mentors, but with all of the past fellows. So it's sort of like, once you're a fellow in Paraplus, you're always a fellow. The application can be found at bit.ly/paraplusfaq. So that's PERIPLUSFAQ. That's where you can find a link to the application. We're also on Twitter as the Paraplus Collective and on email at paraplescollective@gmail.com. And so people can find us at all of those places. The deadline, the application just opened this year, and the deadline is September 26th. Any emerging writer of color can apply. There are a couple of restrictions, like you can't currently be in a graduate creative writing program, for example. You can't have published a book with a major press, but you can look at all of those guidelines, and you are absolutely invited to apply if you're a writer of color.
Well, that's wonderful. Wahine Vara, it's just been delightful to talk with you about your short story collection. This is Salvaged. Thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun.
This is Salvaged is out from Norton Press. Go to writersvoice.net for links to more of Wahine Vara's writing. And here's a note about a book newly available to American readers from Bloomsbury Press. Fall is a premium time for those gardeners who want to prepare the ground for a beautiful garden in the spring, especially perennials. And if you want to create an abundant habitat for pollinators, and who doesn't, you will be inspired by a gorgeous new book by celebrated British wildlife photographer Heather Angel. It's called Planting for Pollinators, Creating a Garden Haven. Filled with stunning photos, the book provides insights and inspiration for transforming your garden, balcony, or even a modest window box into a buzzing paradise for pollinators. From bees to butterflies, Planting for Pollinators shows how these little heroes are vital for our planet and our pantry. No bees, no berries. The book offers an array of over 100 plant species, categorized by season, as well as fascinating facts about how plants and pollinators communicate, plus tips on wildlife photography. And while the book features plants native to English gardens, the principles it promotes will help you to design a garden anywhere that will please both you and the planet. Heather Angel was president of the Royal Photographic Society from 1984 to 1986. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. And you can read interview transcripts at the Writer's Voice Substack. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.